Welcome to the Share Life podcast with Jason Scott Montoya, where we explore stories and systems to live better and work smarter. Welcome to a Listen to Learn episode of the Share Life podcast. I'm Jason Scott Montoya, and I'm here with Jason Long. Jason, say hello.
Hello. It's good to see everybody.
Jason was on the first episode of the podcast, and he is probably the most popular visitor, as this is, I think, his fourth appearance on the Share Life podcast. So thank you, Jason, for all your contributions.
And thank you so much for having me on this many times.
We've talked about a range of topics, but today we're going to talk about his most recent experience. And the title of this talk is called Scaling Yourself. And I asked Jason, we recently got together at some Korean barbecue, and asked him if he would join the podcast to share about this particular experience where he was brought in as the CEO of this established, broken company, much different than the small businesses he had run and operated before that, and went through this experience and eventually selling it for $14 million. So I want him to talk about that experience, what he learned along the way, and how he scaled himself up to make that process possible. So Jason, tell us about you. Tell us a little bit about your background and how that led up to this business leadership role.
All right. So my name is Jason Long. I've been an agency owner for about, it says 20 years in there, but it's coming up on 25 years. I founded more than 10 businesses, something like, I think I added up the other day, like 15 businesses now. And then about three and a half years ago, I got a call from a private equity group to come in and be a professional CEO doing a turnaround project on one of their failing assets. And that was a big difference, a big change for me. At first, I actually said no to the deal, but after thinking about it and also with the fact that COVID was coming in, I decided to take it.
I was gonna say, did the lead come in before COVID, when it COVID came, was becoming prominent, or after it, or it was already prominent?
It came in originally in 2019. The way that I got connected to this group was really extremely serendipitous. Lucky, I guess, would maybe be the better word. Early 2019, I want to say it was January of 2019, January 2nd of 2019, I had been doing a lot of content about building, scaling, growing SaaS businesses, software as a service businesses. And January 2nd, something happened with Google, and we were ranking number one, number two, number three, number four, number five, number six, and number seven on all sorts of keywords having to do with SaaS just for one day. Our normal hits on that site at that time was somewhere around 4,000, 4,500 unique viewers per month. That particular day, we had somewhere in the range of 8,000 viewers.
Wow.
So we just were ranking number one for everything. And one of the people that called us that day was a gentleman looking to build something that I actually shot down. He called me up, and it's actually a really, really funny story. He called me up and he was like, I have this idea for this thing. I want you guys to build it. And I was like, cool. You know what? Tell me what it is. We only build stuff that's going to make money. And if your idea is not a good idea at that company, we don't build it. The last thing we want at JH Media Group is to build something that's not going to work, that we know is not going to work right out the gate. And then the purchaser will come back later and be upset or whatever. And so we don't do that. And so the idea he had was for a virtual high school graduation. And I remember so clearly telling him the only way this is ever going to work is if there is a worldwide pandemic that shuts down the entire world. Because high school graduation is the only thing everybody, like the whole family, shows up for so many families.
Yeah.
How was I supposed to know? You know, like that's... anyway, I told him we weren't going to build it. And then he came to me with another idea, and I didn't like that idea either. And I was like, no, man, I don't think you're going to make any money. We're not going to build that. And then he came to me with this third idea, and it was a private equity focused tool that he really, really knew a lot about. And so I started asking him about what he did and how he did it, because he'd been kind of secretive before. At that point, he said, you know, you've looked out for our best interests for months now as I've been pitching these ideas and shooting them down. And okay. So I'm just going to tell you, I'm a general partner or GP at a mid-sized private equity firm. And the reason I know a lot about this tool is because, you know, I'm on the finance side, and that's what this tool was, and he was in charge of that piece. And so that was how we kind of got started talking about his role in private equity. And it was a few months later that he called me and he said, look, you know, we've been working together now for a while, which we had on that other project. And he said, we have an asset that we purchased that's not doing great. And I was wondering if you would come in and take a look at it and let me know what you think. And so I consulted on that asset for a while. And then about, March of 2021. So this was the 2020, sorry. So this was the following year. They called me up and they said, hey, are you interested in taking a stab at leading that company? And at that time, by the way, this was a business unit of a much larger business that they wanted to stabilize, spin off, and sell. Yeah. And at first I said no, but COVID was coming in. There was a lot of uncertainty about what was going to happen. They made me a really good offer. And I wanted to learn. I wanted to learn how they did things in private equity. And I was able to step away from my portfolio. So I stepped up and I took it.
Wow. So did you know the hornet's nest you were stepping into at that point?
Man, I had no idea. This business had some serious problems. So yeah, this company had, let me read it off here, the worst reputation in the industry. We were losing 15 to 20% of customers every year for the last 7 years. That was 1 to 2 million ARR, or annual recurring revenue, per year. We had a product that I spent hours and hours and hours trying to figure out how to learn this thing. I couldn't figure it out. It was a product that was 30 years old and had never once had a designer work on it. So in my opinion, it was an unusable product without substantial training. System architecture was more than 20 years old. The company had no branding. It had no website. It had the company name sounded like an internet service provider. You couldn't tell what it did. We had no sales team. We had no marketing team. We had no marketing. We had millions of dollars in aged accounts receivable, and it would take 6 weeks from the time a customer asked us for new work for us to actually get them a contract. And the biggest thing is that when I started interviewing people, asking them what the company did, nobody could give me a clear answer. And that was probably the biggest red flag in the whole thing. It was a company that was probably 6 months to a year from total failure.
So what if someone's in that spot now? What do you what do you say to them?
Good luck. Good luck. This is something that took me 3 years two and a half years at 80 hours a week to put together. And to some extent, I was still lucky to be able to get it done. Oh, you know what? Actually, something that's not on here. This company was losing between $200,000 and $250,000 per month when I got the business. When we sold the business, we were cash flow neutral. Mm-hmm. So it was a substantial turnaround.
What period of time? 3 years?
3 years.
Yeah.
3 years. Although we cut most of it. Most of it was cut at the end of the second year when a number of contracts terminated, which we did not renew, and that were just eating a ton of our money. We made a number of cuts. It was unfortunate we had to do that, but that's, you know, the company was going to go under otherwise. And
And tell us about the backstory here in terms of, like, you were the Hail Mary here with all the other people they had brought in and had run away screaming, right?
So I was within the greater group, which was a big company, and this was a subunit. For the bigger company, I was the sixth CEO in 6 years to come in for the overseeing this particular subgroup. Right? Like there were six CEOs in 6 years. I think of the bigger group, six CEOs over 6 years of that bigger group who then oversaw that smaller group. I was the first leader that I know of that just took over that smaller group. And so people are just seeing this revolving door of CEOs coming and going that really, in my opinion, were making a lot of mistakes leading the organization.
Yeah, which just compounded it when you arrived, right?
Exactly. Yeah, by the time I got there, there was a big, there was no trust in leadership. You know, when I came in, people were like, all right, great. Yep, another leader. I'll see you. See your way out the door in another 6 months. And yeah, fortunately, I was able to not do that.
Yeah, yeah. So you're a responsible type of person. How does the stress of that, like you're thinking how it ought to be done, and it's obviously a disaster. How do you handle the stress of that situation?
This may have been one of the biggest ways that I changed as a leader going through all of this. Actually, I have a couple slides here. Yeah. I went into this as an experienced operations-focused entrepreneur. I came out as a professional CEO. And part of this was when I came in, I was used to having a big emotional connection to my business. Mm-hmm. And when I left, I had an emotional connection to the people, but not so much to the business. I think maybe that was actually what I learned the most about private equity, is I got to see how they look at business so much more clinically than most entrepreneurs do, because entrepreneurs have this like love of their business. You know, they're in it. They're doing it.
Would you say operating. Them and the business are the same thing in a way?
It depends on, well, so I would have said that in my past, yes, that was me. But now it's not.
Yeah, that's even where you shifted. Oh, these are separate. These are now separate.
Yep, exactly. And but it's still hard to separate a little bit. When you go to work every day organizing, running, you know, operating a business, like you put yourself into that.
Yeah.
But when you're once you're on the sales side of things, once you're selling that business, or the way private equity does, they're selling lots of businesses, you start to see it as another tool in your toolbox. You know, it's just like it's a car or a shovel or a hammer or a computer or a camera or whatever. It's just another tool. In this case, it's a tool to make money and to make your life good and to contribute value to the world.
Yeah. Yeah. So how does kind of separating yourself in that way, you can still go inside of the business or look at it clinically, like you said, from the outside. What advantages does that give you or give anyone that sort of makes that upgrade?
I think it gives you a huge advantage. I think it's really funny. My grandfather was the one that used to hammer this into me. He always said, don't fall in love with your businesses. Businesses are there to make you money and to make your life good. And I so many times I made the mistake of falling in love with my businesses. And when you make emotional decisions, a lot of times you're not making the right decision. And when you're able to really step away and put that distance between you and your business, all of a sudden you can look at it, like I said, from a distance, you can look at it like a machine, not like a person. And you can make the changes that need to be made. Like a lot of times people don't fire people because of their emotions. People keep the wrong people in the wrong seats because of their emotions. People invest in the wrong things because of their emotions. But once you're able to separate it and just look at it like just another object, you can make much more precise decisions about your business.
Yeah. So then how do you harmonize that with sort of the extreme of going so far that you actually are callous to the people that your decisions affect? In other words, how do you have a balance between that objectivity and also taking care of people?
You know, it's I've actually thought about this a number of times. It's a little bit paradoxical.
Yeah.
Depends on how you look at it. So you can still have, I think you need to have, to be a great leader, I think you need to have empathy and, you know, be agreeable and be a lot of things to be a great leader. But you have to be able to connect with people. People are the center of everything. At the same time, you have to do what's best for the business, because the business is what's supporting those people and providing the value to other people. And yeah. So, you know, it's really about being both at the same time, being that, you know, having that clinical look, realizing that sometimes you have to make big cuts. And because if you don't make those cuts, the whole thing dies. All of it dies. Everything goes away. But if, you know, it's things like that that just that make it kind of paradoxical. I wish I had a really good answer for you. You have to be both. You have to be clinical and empathetic at the same time.
Well, I guess one thing that does come to mind is you mentioned it's almost like the emotion you talked about. If you're not if you are looking at it emotionally, I'll take, for example, in was it 2021 when all these tech companies were doing super successful and they hired all these people, which they've now laid off. In some senses, I kind of wonder, were they not objective and clinical? They hired a bunch of people out of emotion, and now they have to deal with the consequences of that. Where if they had actually been more wise in their approach, they may have prevented that all along. I don't know if that would be a good example of what you're describing or not, but that came to mind.
I don't think so in this case, because a lot of the reason they did that was because of venture funding. So a lot of these companies got venture capital, and venture is all about growth. It's all about increasing that valuation. And so when you're trying to grow, what are you trying to do? You're trying to bring on more sales, more revenue. And so you invest heavily in your sales, in your marketing, sometimes customer success, other kinds of departments that are customer facing, that are driving growth. But what happens is that you can only grow so fast. So you get all this venture money, people are being pressured to grow as quickly as possible, but there's no way, like the market's not ready for it. And so they hire all these people, but they really only can take a certain number of people at one time. Either people are hiring the wrong people, or even if they have great people, the market's just not ready for it. And so they can't grow fast enough, and so they end up having to lay those people off. And in a lot of cases, they blow through a lot of the money that they probably shouldn't have blown through, and now they have to lay more people off. And I think that was more of the reason that we saw these big, you know, a lot of these companies, startup companies especially, growing really, really fast and then being cut back. I know that there's also a lot that happened in the larger organizations as well, having to do with just kind of environmental forces. You know, high liquidity market enables lots of money to come into the business, thus more hires, more spending, and then when liquidity drops, there's less demand, thus we need less people, et cetera. So I think it was kind of both of those factors together, depending upon whether you're talking about established businesses or startup businesses.
Yeah. So I think what you're adding is now a third layer, which is, so you've got this, your personal emotional connection or attachment, you have the business itself, and now you have this outside force, in this case, the private equity firms, which you had to deal with as well. And so now you're having this situation where you have this outside force that has financial incentives to push you certain ways. Now you had to deal with that. They push you some ways that are actually going to hurt the business in the case example we're talking about here. But that also happened to you. So tell us some more about that.
So I had a lot of questions about the business. So anytime you're coming in as a CEO, you're paid based on the growth of this business. And you have to have a certain, like, there's a lot of ways it can be structured in your contracts. But basically, you have to have enough money for you to get paid, to, you know, to have your transaction bonus at the end of the deal. And so looking this over, I had a lot of questions. And really, at the end of the day, I think that the private equity group that had made this purchase, it looked like a good purchase on the outside, and I understand why they did it. But when they dug into it, they realized that maybe they had bought more of a lemon than they thought. The business that owned it previously had made some pretty substantial mistakes that weren't necessarily disclosed at the purchase. And so they kind of bought a lemon, and I wasn't there. I don't know exactly how that transaction happened or what exactly went into it, but there were some serious issues when I got the business that the private equity group was not aware of. And that was causing a lot of the loss.
Yeah. So now they have hey, we paid more for this than we should have. We need to get our return. So they push
exactly.
more for it.
Exactly. So like I said, I had a lot of questions about how is this going to work? Not just for them, but also for me. And so, you know, where's the money going to come from? How are we going to grow revenue? What systems are working? What systems aren't working? Is this even a viable project or product? And it was surprising to me how long it took just for those questions to get answered.
Like 3 years?
Like a year. I'd say a year to like, which frankly for doing turnaround CEO work is far too long. Like really, it's the kind of thing you need to figure out really before you take the gig. But, I didn't
and
know
it's
that
part
one
of that
first
because
started.
It took a year because you have all these fires you're having to put out that you don't have time to actually get the answers to these questions that matter.
It was a year because there were a tremendous number of fires to put out, but then also because the finances for the company were not being reported properly. So this had to do with once again the previous ownership or the transition from one owner to another, that it was not clear how much revenue was coming into this organization. And so they couldn't tell how much money they were making. They couldn't tell how much money they were losing. They hadn't been listing out cancellations over time. So, you know, people would cancel and they were still recording revenue for it, recognizing revenue for it. And so There was no way to tell because just the previous ownership hadn't been logging this stuff appropriately. There were all sorts of issues there. A really good example of this is that when the transition from one company to another happened, they used to have all the contracts in a giant folder, like a gigantic, like thousands of pages in this giant folder or set of folders. When they were taking that to scan it and take it all digital, somebody dropped the folder on the ground and contracts went flying everywhere. This was years before I got there, when they were doing the transaction or transition to the private equity group. And now we have thousands of pages that are not labeled. You can't tell which contract it goes to. And somebody just scooped them all back up, stuck them to the printer and clicked scan.
So you have and all so these can't contracts tell, that's intermixed.
Yeah. And the original contracts at this point are gone. There's no way to find the originals. All we have are these thousands of pages, which are a total jumble. And so we actually had two people spend 6 months reading contracts, trying to figure out how to organize them.
Wow.
Yeah. And then on top of that, and the real problem here is that the sales and finance teams had not been well connected over the course of about 10 years. And the sales team had been enabled or allowed to act in a way that was not beneficial for the business, in that they were doing deals where they were giving large discounts and there was no oversight. And they were doing things where they bundled things together, but they didn't list what was being bundled. So for example, like we would sell to a customer had facilities had modules. The contract would just say customer name, $10,000 per month. But it wouldn't say which facility had which modules. So let's say, or for example, they might say customer name, five facilities, and then these five facilities get 10 of these modules, 10 of these, three of these, two of these, one of those. No indication of which thing went where. 5 years later, that company sells three facilities, buys three facilities. They do it again. Buy another three, sell another five. Do it again. And each one of these was just an addendum contract that went on top. Then now, by the end, it was just saying $10,000. Customer owes $10,000 per month. No indication of which modules, which facility, how much money, how much do we charge per module, any of that stuff. Yeah. And so it was impossible to tell how much money we had coming into the business. The only way to tell was actually call the customers in a lot of cases and ask them. But we signed contracts.
How much are you paying us?
Well, no, like, what do you have? What are you using? But in a lot of cases, the people that signed the contracts signed it 30 years ago and are dead. And so it was it took a long time to get that sorted out.
Yeah. And how come this company was not dead itself?
It was on its way. It was somebody was nailing nails in the coffin when I got there.
You're like, wait a second, let me take a look at this corpse before you bury it.
Yeah. There were two different executives on the C-suite that both pulled me aside and they're like, look, this thing has got 6 months to a year before it's totally insolvent. If we have another year like last year where we lost our biggest customers, we're done. Like, that's it. If you can't change the morale, if you can't change the culture, if you can't change the product, if you can't get customers to believe in this company again, it's done.
Yeah. Now, your background is in the product. It's the tech, it's building, you know, applications and software. And this company is based on a software, right? So tell us about that angle.
So I come from a software background. I've launched a number of SaaS businesses and also in healthcare. And this was a healthcare tech business. That said, I had never run anything this size. But I had a pretty good idea. The business, when I got the business, it was the first year I got it, it had recognized the previous year, $7.2 million, but it had lost the better part of 30% by the time I got it. I got the business in July, very end of June or beginning of July 2020. But they had already lost a huge amount that year. And like I said, the previous year, they had recognized 7.2. But I want to say that by the end of that first year, we were on track to have recognized like 6.2, something like that. And then by the time I got it stabilized, we were recognizing about $5.3 million.
And how many team members were there when you
joined? Let's go 67, something around there. And how many? And then when I got done, there were 41.
Okay, 41. So over 3 years.
Yeah.
And how many of those 41 were part of the 70?
The vast majority. I tried to keep as many people as possible. We did have some people that needed to go. I didn't really want to let people go. The goal was not to come in and cut. The goal was to save the business and save the people. And at the end of the day, I really feel like that's what we did. We took the vast majority of people that were able to save, and we delivered them to a company that was going to keep them around and continue employing them ongoing for a long time. And help that business grow to be a real, real force in the industry.
Yeah. And so, how much of I guess in terms of the technology itself, what was the application like when you got in?
Extremely difficult to use. It was built for nurses, and it's interesting because I talk to a lot of nurses. And nurses would tell me that they know what good software is because they have it on their phones. But in the industry, they're used to using terrible software. And so in a lot of cases, they were just kind of used to this stuff. And I felt like that was something that needed to change in the industry. And that was actually a big change that we made, is we brought in a team of senior UX designers and front-end developers to come in and help revamp the entire front end of the product. And it was a 5-year roadmap to do that. We got about 3 years into that roadmap. And we ended up having to extend it out a little bit, especially in a few specific areas. And it would probably end up being more like a 2030 roadmap by the time we really, really got everything done. But I felt like we were making great progress as we in those first 2 years.
Yeah. And was it like as messy as you described those contracts in terms of how do you even figure out how this application was developed so that you can change it?
This was a monster-sized product. This is a product that at one point was probably being worked on by a 100 dev team. It used to be a very large company. And so it was a massive, massive system and had been cut down to bare bones development staff. We had about 30 people all together on the production side of the company. So everything from technical writing to development to QA, all of that. And the people that we had were absolutely top notch. They were fantastic. And so they were hesitant, I think, to let a new guy in who wanted to go and change a bunch of stuff. But after they saw the power of design thinking and usability, they jumped on it. And it made a huge difference in the product and in the team. And does that answer your question? I don't know if I clearly got to the answer there.
Yeah, I think so. I guess in terms of, in some ways you have the product as a problem, and then you also have the people there that are they in survival mode and they're sort of holding on to it? Is that kind of what you're describing?
They didn't realize where they were. They had been in a bubble. Like this was a company that did not talk about the status of the company with its employees. Like this was a big change that I made, is that everybody, I would take anybody who wanted through the books whenever they wanted. Every single week we talked about how much money we had, what our revenue looked like, what our expenses looked like, all of that stuff. Every single week with the entire business, we talked about that. We talked about it extensively within the leadership team, which is something that they had never done before. And so they didn't know where they were. They didn't know where the business was. One of the first things I did is I presented, this is where we stand in the market. And people on the team messaged me and they're like, I thought we were a lot bigger. We used to be 50% of the market. Mm-hmm. You're telling me now we're less than 2%? I was like, yeah, that's exactly where you stand. And they're like, oh, I had no idea.
Yeah, so they had assumed it was just where it used to be. And it had
I think that everybody knew it was smaller, but they didn't know how small it had gotten, how much this company had shrunk. Mm.
Well, that's interesting because the specifics matter, right? And you talk about... Yep. All the little things adding up. So talk more about that.
Oh, wow. Yeah, the specifics matter. Like this business is the sum of its parts, you know, like it's the people, it's the processes, it's the management, it's the money, it's the finance systems. It's all of these different things. I actually have an entire structure that I use that breaks down all the different parts of that business. Actually, I have a slide on it.
Pull it up.
Hold on 1 second. I close it. Oh, here it is. Give me 1 sec. I'll share it. Find what I did with it. Here we go. Yeah, this is the business operating support structure, BOSS. So mission, vision, values, data, analytics and data, people and culture, procedures, processes and policies, money and finance, execution and accountability. It's all, a business is all of these different parts. Yeah. And when I'm looking at a business and looking at how to fix these things, I have a set of questions I ask myself about every different part of each one of these items. Each one of these items can be broken down into a set of questions and or statements, and whether the company has them or not. And that's what I looked at, is I went through all of these different pieces. And a lot of times what I'll do is I'll actually go through and figure out, like, ask the questions for the team members, or if I'm coaching somebody, I have a questionnaire for them, and it builds out a spider chart that shows me exactly where the company is strong and where the company is weak.
Yeah, that's awesome. So talk about the vision, mission, values in terms of, did the company have that when you went in? Was it clarified? And
no.
Was it even relevant anymore?
There was no mission, there was no vision, there was no values. None of these things existed in the organization when I got there.
Had it ever existed?
I think they had it at the top level, But I don't think that they, one, they didn't know what it was. They didn't pay attention to it. Like nobody, if you asked anybody on the team, they couldn't tell you what their mission vision or what their mission vision or values were. I don't believe they had, I think they had a mission statement, but like I said, nobody knew what it was. They definitely didn't have a set of values that was stated. You know, this is something that's important. If a company's been around for a long time, they have a set of values. It just a lot of times hasn't been vocalized. And part of coming in as a CEO is helping them understand what their own values are. Especially, you know, this was a company full of great people. They had great values. They have great values. When I came into this, a lot of what I did was just help them get it on paper and make sure that everyone agreed and everybody understood it. You know, the values of a business are critically important because the values are what you hire and fire on. And if
you don't know what that last one, execution accountability, you can't do it without that first one.
Exactly. Exactly.
Yeah. But you Matt, you walked into massive confusion is what it, like a cloud of confusion. And that's what it sounds like you were trying to sort of tease out, get clarity. Okay. On this piece.
Yep. Yeah, for sure. I wouldn't call it confusion. I would actually call it, they didn't know where they were going. They didn't have a direction. And so they had no way to get there. It wasn't like the people doing their jobs were not necessarily confused. They had been doing these jobs for a long time. The average person there was something like 55 years old. And they'd been working in this business for a very long time. And they knew their job very well. But there had been no leadership over the business, over the organization. And so there was no direction. It was a rudderless ship. And that was the problem.
Yeah. So people doing their roles, but they're all kind of paddling against each other instead of in unison towards the vision.
Exactly. They were, in some cases, they were absolutely paddling against each other. And in some cases, they were paddling together. But where were they going? Nobody knew.
Yeah. We're going in circles, right?
Exactly. And very much they were going in circles. So they didn't, they had people in the wrong places, on this ship. They had people that didn't belong there and needed to move on. They had people that had moved on that took critical tribal knowledge with them that was really hard to get back. And in fact, we ended up going back and re-employing some of those people that had left that brought back huge amounts of knowledge with them. Some of the problems there was that there were no business basics pieces. Actually, let me go back to my business basics slides. So per what we were saying, they didn't have a value proposition. They didn't know what they were providing. They didn't have a mission, vision, and values. They didn't have SOPs. Different departments had SOPs in certain ways, but in many cases, they were very disorganized. In a lot of cases, it's just because people had been there forever and they didn't feel like they needed it and there was no push to have it. And so one of the first things I did was bring in an SOPs system and help everybody get into that system. There was no task management. People would give each other tasks. And then I would email people and be like, hey, can you take care of this for me? And it would just go away. It was just gone. There was no way to manage and track those tasks. So I brought in task management, team communications. They were communicating everything over Skype when I got there, which was not an efficient system to use.
Yeah. Like chat or video or both?
Both, but there was no way to do groups. And there was, there was not the good structure. There's no recording of this. There was no way to connect it to things. It was, and then different people used different things too. Some people wouldn't use it at all. And so, they just sent things to email, or some people just called each other. So we set up standardized team communications, in this case using Microsoft Teams. I prefer Google products, but this was a company that had been on Microsoft for many years, and it was not feasible to take them off of that.
Yeah. So, this is interesting because, those business basics, I think, I guess for you and I, they seem obvious in a lot of ways, but if you're just a person in a role in a company and you don't, you're not thinking this way, you use what's available to you. Is that pretty much what happened, or what was no one's that, thinking? Exactly, maybe there's a better way.
People have been doing it for so long that I think that they had just gotten used to it. There were definitely people in the company that knew that there was a better way, but remember that it also came from being a very large company, a very siloed company, and a very hierarchical company. So people didn't feel like they had the right to put their hand up and say, we need to make a change. Because I have this feeling that previous administrations, for people that had said, hey, this isn't working, those people got their heads chopped off. And so everybody that was remaining was like, exactly, we're not putting our heads up, we're not saying anything, this is the way it is, and I'm fine with that.
Yeah. And so how did you help them overcome that timidity?
Oh man, this took a while. It was particularly hard because, you know, I was the younger guy coming in, and I think I was a younger guy. I was one of many CEOs that have been through, and the lack of trust in senior leadership was extremely low. So what I did is I tried to lead by example, first off. So show up to everything, be everywhere, meet with everyone, have conversations about more than just business, about people, about people's families, about their lives, about, you know, forming real relationships with people, not just pushing the business forward. And then understand what the problems in the business were, what was holding people back, slowly start to dissolve those walls and those silos, and build trust through education. I have a lot of experience over the past 25 years building a lot of businesses and bringing those new ideas into this business and showing people how those new ideas would work for the business really made an enormous difference in their trust, because they got to see, you know, like I would come in, I would make a change, and they'd say, oh, well, that's the thing we've been asking for, and he brought things to it that I didn't even know existed, and it's working. Yeah. And if it wasn't working, we changed it. We changed it fast. That's what built trust. Making people's lives better, making people's jobs easier, that builds trust.
Yeah. And I guess part of what you're describing in the education is transparency, right? You're demonstrating, you're saying something, you're demonstrating it, and then you're showing the outcomes. You're not a black box, right?
Yep. Not only not a black box, like I said, we're talking about the numbers. We're talking about things, the books. We're talking about things that the rest of the team had never had access to. No one had ever thought to give them access, never wanted to give them access. And now not only was I giving them access, but I was making them look at it. And all of a sudden, I think they felt more in control as well. Mm. Because they knew through looking at the numbers and having very clear goals, it made sense as to how we were driving things up through the business. Actually, here, I've got a picture here. one of our... Excuse me. Sorry. One of our goal sheets right here. This is kind of the new and improved version. We would set up goal sheets where people could see the goals the company had and then the implication that had on the revenue, on the expenses, and on the growth of the business. And all of a sudden, people felt in control. They felt in control and they understood what success looked like for them within their role and what success looked like for the business holistically.
Yeah. Yeah, that's interesting.
So it made a big difference, and I had a bunch of lessons learned on that as well. If you want me to go through some of them,
well, yeah. But first, before we do that, what would you say to that person that is in this kind of context of distrust, and they're scared to be transparent about it in the way that you're describing because it's not good? What would you tell that leader?
the leader of the people, let's say a new leader coming in, or a leader that's leading a team that has grown to distrust that person.
I'm thinking the latter, but one if you want to share both, that would be fine too.
So somebody coming in, you know, it's... At the end of the business, so when I exited the business, the team put together this really, really amazing PowerPoint for me. It wasn't a PowerPoint, it was a presentation. It was a video that they did where everybody got together and they shot clips of the things they learned from me. The things that I taught them, or the things that I inspired them on, the things that made them feel good about working with me. And it was like a 30, 40 minute clip or video with all of these clips of all these different people saying things. But there was one person I didn't see in that clip, in that video, and he had actually sent me an email separately. And he said, look, he said, you know, I had some personal things I wanted to say to you, and I didn't feel comfortable having it just out in front of everybody. And he had, his name is Neil Cox, and he had some of the kindest, best words for me, some of the most meaningful words for me. He talked about how one of the things that he really liked, he talked about a lot of things, but one of the things he really liked was that he said he felt like for the first time in his entire career, in like, I'll say 30 years, he had a leader that would talk to him about his kids. Mm. He had a leader that didn't just ask about goals, but wanted to know about his history and about his life and about his family. He had a leader that had an open door policy where he could call at any time and have a conversation. And maybe you couldn't call me right on the phone and just talk to me right then, but you know, have to schedule time because everybody's busy. But that always was interested in talking, and that if he had a problem, would listen. And, you know, would direct things the right way, because sometimes it needs to go through his manager. But I was always there to listen and to talk and to be a real person, not just a figurehead at the top of the organization. And so there's a lot that goes into answering that question. But I think that actually caring about people is at the core of it.
Yeah. And so, well, what if someone says is like, well, I do care about people, but I don't want to be the bearer of bad news. I don't want to, you know, maybe they're in survival mode with that, or is maybe that's a cover story. They're not really caring about people.
Well, I mean, sometimes great businesses, or good businesses, maybe not great businesses, but good businesses can still get into survival mode. Environments can change, you know, like with the rise of the internet, lots of businesses went out of business. You know, with the changing, just the environment shifts and great business models no longer exist. You know, yeah. Things that magazines, we're not selling things through magazines anymore. Yeah. Not very much at least.
Yeah.
And so, you know, it's totally possible for good businesses, great businesses to run into survival mode. I think that transparency still has to be metered, though, because you have to give people as much as they can handle. And knowing what they can handle and what they can't handle is maybe one of those difficult jobs that a CEO has. You know, you can't tell everybody everything. There were so many times during this story where I would call the COO and I'd be like, I don't know what we're going to do. I am... like, our back is against the wall. We don't have any money coming in. We got problems. Private equity is breathing down our neck. We've got, you know, our clients are pissed. We have serious problems. The business wasn't dying, but we had problems. We had a plan. So what we did, we put together a plan to start dealing with it. What we did for the team is we presented the plan. We presented, everybody knew there was a problem. Maybe they didn't know how bad the problem was, but what they did know is that we're working on solving the problem. And there are times when you have to come out and say, hey, look, we got serious problems right now and we need everybody to buckle down. But if you do that too much, all of a sudden people start leaving. Like, what you can't do is have people be scared. You know, people have to feel strength in leadership, because if you don't, they'll start bailing, and then you have way more serious problems.
Yeah.
So fine line to walk.
Yeah. Well, discerning the difference between what to say and what not to. And I think part of it is, if you have a healthier business and you have that as a practice, you never get to the point where you have to do that, because you're always sharing along the way. So it kind of as a natural progression, whereas when you're in the middle of a catastrophe, it's a little different.
Yeah.
And yeah, sometimes you look into the abyss and it stares back, right? So
yeah, it does.
So yeah. Let's jump into some of the lessons learned and walk through those.
Actually, let me go back a little bit here. So if you take a look, these were the major changes we did in the business. So starting in June 2020, we implemented business basics, the stuff that we were just talking about. September 2020, we started going into people and culture, making people shifts, you know, cutting some people, moving people around, hiring a number of people, filling roles. We started early working on product and churn, but it was really like there was a lot of preparation before we really got going on it. We really got going on it around January 2021. Marketing and reputation also got going in 2021. Yeah.
Did you find that making changes and like moving in the right direction actually made things worse right away in some ways?
No.
Like you all of a sudden you're kind of talking about things, and then people are like, well, I guess if we're reconsidering our service, we might as well leave now. you know, do you just start to trigger people thinking about things because you're now thinking about those things, right?
So the gentleman I was talking about that gave me that this extremely meaningful video at the end of my tenure at that business, he brought up something I didn't even realize. He said that when I joined the business, about half of the staff was considering bailing. And these are people who've known each other for many, many, many years. They were talking about this. They were talking about just being done. Just in a lot of cases, retiring and just being done. And I think that initial transparency and that energy, that's a big shift in the energy of the business, was what gave people enough hope to stick around long enough to see how things really did change.
Did that include clients or just the staff?
Definitely included clients. Absolutely included clients. In fact, during the time that we were there, we only had two people leave. One because he retired, and another woman because she had been doing this role for a very long time and she was just ready to go do something else.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. So continue with your timeline.
Yep. So in January 2021, we started working on reputation and management. March, we started working on the sales really hard. Finance, January 2022, we really started working on finance. And August 23, we sold the business. So that takes us down to lessons learned from our business basics, which were implementing systems like EOS, which is the entrepreneurial operating system from Traction, OKRs from Measure What Matters, or my system, Boss. It takes 3 quarters to fully implement this stuff. A lot of people think that you can get it done pretty quickly, but it really takes a minimum of 3 quarters, very often a full year, to really get it done. Something that I knew, but I didn't really realize how much until I came into an organization like this, is that people know the bad apples, and they really appreciate it when you get rid of them. Like this was something like, I think everybody kind of knows, but a lot of times business leaders, they're hesitant to remove people. They have a hard, people in general have a hard time firing people. And once you do, coming into an organization like this, that's actually something that drives a lot of respect as well, is when you remove the bad apples and you open the gates for people to do their work. And that was something I didn't realize how much that made a difference until I came into this organization.
Yeah, especially, I guess, bad apples that also have authority as well.
Exactly. That was exactly it. And yeah. Fortunately, I was in a spot where we implemented systems that allowed them those people to realize that they weren't a good fit for this business anymore, and they stepped out themselves. We didn't have to really make a lot of fires to do that. We had a number of people just decide that this was not the right business for them, mm-hmm. and leave.
Yeah, accountability will do that, right?
And that was exactly what it was. People were suddenly being held accountable that had never been held accountable, and they realized that maybe that wasn't for them.
Yeah.
Yep. All right, so next up. But that said, don't listen to everyone without investigating. We had one person who multiple people told me, this guy is just a bad apple. He's not doing anything. He's not doing a good job. And upon investigation, it turned out he was actually one of the only guys in that department that really did know what they were doing. And he was a squeaky wheel because he saw all the problems and he couldn't fix them himself. And he was just screaming about fixing the problems, and people didn't like to hear him screaming. And so they saw that as being a problem, when in reality, he was one of the reasons that entire department got fixed.
Yeah, and were they problems themselves, the people that were pointing to him?
Yeah, there were other people in the department that were definitely problems. So, but that said, we cleared that department out pretty quickly, and eventually, I want to say he was the only one from that entire department who ended up staying on with the business. We filled out the rest of that department.
Yeah.
Let's see. Consistent messaging. This was something else. We talked about how nobody in the business could tell me what the business did. In a lot of cases, what we realized is that nobody had a consistent message about what the business did. And this is something that when I start looking at it for other complex businesses, you start seeing this more and more, is that if you don't have consistent messaging about what your business does, different employees will tell you different things. In the same way, like if you don't have mission, vision, and values, you don't have a good culture, people will act in ways that you don't want them to act because the culture is not there. The same thing applies to how people explain what your product is or service is and what it does. And so we put together a consistent messaging package and we distributed it across the business and we quizzed people on it, and it made a difference in a big difference in the way customers saw us. And then we talked a lot about this, the difference between management and leadership. This team had been managed, but not led. And it was like really clear when you see a team. Say it again.
Like a management culture. We're just keeping ourselves busy.
Yeah, to some extent. Well, there was good management in place, but once again, there was no goal that they were reaching for. Yeah. They had systems. Sometimes the systems didn't work, but they did have systems, but they didn't have direction. And I think that seeing the effect of that on a company that was so lost, really, it really struck a chord with me, seeing how a company that was lost could so quickly redirect itself and start steering in the right direction once it had leadership.
Yeah. In other words, they were hungry for it.
They were yeah. So hungry. I have a slide I don't think we're going to get to that talks about the development team, how the average developer, I want to say, was 60 years old. And I talked to a number of consultants coming into this, and they said, hey, you know, maybe this team is too old, or you know, you're going to have to make changes there. And I said, I don't think so. These guys know what they're doing. And what I realized very quickly was that those developers really, really wanted to learn new stuff. They wanted to make a difference. They wanted to make changes. And they had been begging for it for years and years and years and years. And as soon as you just opened the door, they jumped on it. And they made those changes really, really quickly.
Yeah, that's cool.
Let me see. I got another one. Nope. The next goes into people and culture.
Oh, okay. Do you have more lessons learned on that, on other topics, or?
For each one of those different time sections, I have lessons learned on each one of those.
Okay. Well, where do you want to jump to next?
You know,
what do you think is worth highlighting?
We kind of talked about a lot of discussed. These. Yeah, let's go into lessons learned on people and culture. We didn't really go into all the problems there, but we went into a fair number of them. So, culture change requires trust and accountability. It's sometimes threats and sometimes examples. I don't think it's a really good or nice thing to make examples of people, but if in this situation where you're in the middle of a raging battle, you know days count. It's not like you have years to make changes and things can move slowly the way that this company was used to doing. Days counted. And so sometimes I had to make threats and sometimes I had to make examples. And I'll give you a good example of that. There were a number of people when I got there. Like I said, they didn't have a task management system. And so when I got there, what I realized is that people would email each other asking for help with something and no one would ever respond to them. The person they had emailed would just never respond. It didn't happen all the time, but it happened on a very regular basis. That was part of the culture of that business. And I think it had to do, things would just disappear all the time. And so after, I don't know, it must have been 2 weeks-ish, 3 weeks, something like that, maybe a month, I got on an all-hands meeting and I said, listen, if I send you an email, you need to respond to it. If your teammate sends you an email, you need to respond to it. If you don't respond to my email, I'll fire you. And if you don't respond to your teammates' emails, I'll fire you. Respond to your everybody's emails. This is not a threat. This is a fact. It's not a bluff. It's not a bluff. Yeah. I was like, listen, we cannot have this anymore. As of today, it changes.
Well, it was a toxic behavior that had to require a shock to change.
Exactly.
That, right?
And it changed. It changed immediately. That said, we also helped people by giving them access to a task management system and training them on it. And that was part of that talk. It was like, listen, this can't ever happen anymore. If I send you an email, you don't have to respond today. You don't have to respond in 5 minutes. You don't respond immediately. You can respond next week, but you've got to respond. And if it's time sensitive, you need to respond by the time that thing is happening within reason. Like send you something at 10 o'clock at night, you don't need to get back to me until you get in the morning and you get to work and all of that. We want to have a good work environment. We want to have a good work-life balance, but people have to be responsive. And so we had to make some examples, some threats like that and some examples, and people got it pretty fast and they changed pretty fast. Yeah. But like I said, I wouldn't say you need to go in and chop heads right away.
Yeah.
But sometimes you've got to really, got to make a threat and be serious about it.
Yeah.
We already talked about gaining, I gained trust by leading by example and meeting with every person, like being in lots and lots and lots of meetings and having people realize that I was everywhere, that if something wasn't going right, I was going to see it. There was no escaping from that. And that made a big difference pretty fast.
Yeah.
And then let's see, next up, hope for a brighter future may have been the best thing I gave the frontline workers. Like I said, we had a lot of people that were looking at bailing in the business, and really what they needed was hope. It was just hope that things were going to be okay. And it's something they hadn't had in a long time. They had had a questionably kind of toxic culture in the business. And I don't even say it was questionable. A number of people told me they had a toxic culture in the business and a very low morale. And when they saw morale was changing, when they saw hope, that's what helped them stick around.
And that's what you said there, I think, is the key. When they saw evidence of change, wasn't that you came in and said, I've got this bright future, and then they got hopeful. It's when they saw the change.
Exactly. Exactly. And actually, let me speak on that. It's not just about talk. It's about real change. It's about making a difference. It's about people seeing it. you know, even those things about making an example, when I know that there were a lot of people in that business that were really frustrated that they would try to get things done and emails would just disappear, tasks would disappear. And of course they were upset. And so having the leader get on in front of everyone and say, it ends today, right now, this minute. If you're not doing this again, you have a conversation with me. If it happens after that, you're done. And all of a sudden it's done. And people are like, okay, there's change. That's hope right there.
So even those little things can make a big difference then.
Oh yeah. Make a huge difference. All right, what we got? Don't chop heads right away. Sometimes you gotta make personnel changes, but I made the mistake in the past of chopping heads right away, and it was a big mistake. It was a really big mistake. In this case, I did not do that, and I tried to keep as many people for as long as possible. In some cases, even underperformers, just to make 100% sure before we did have to remove them. But I felt like that was something that maybe I'd done in the past that I tried not to do as much this time, which I felt like made a difference.
Yeah.
I already talked about this, about being present. Be present, appear to be everywhere in the beginning. This way people can't escape. It took a lot of time and it was tough, but man, I feel like it really made a difference. And then the last one, let me see. No, I got two more. Hold people publicly accountable. You know, you want people to straighten up, hold them publicly accountable. This is something that those goals do. We put in place a goal sheet that every single person in the entire company could see and was required to see every single week. And if you saw the same people not meeting their goals over and over and over again, you knew where the problems were. Or at least, maybe it wasn't always a person problem. Sometimes it was a policy problem or a process problem or an environment problem. But you saw how things were changing quickly, and all of a sudden, with a publicly available and enforced accountability system, people couldn't hide. Yeah. They couldn't escape from accountability, not just from me, but from everybody. And so, because of that, everyone straightened up.
And I
want to make sure to say there were people that were doing a great job at this business. I don't want to say like everybody was failing and. You know, thing like that. There were people that were working super hard, but there were also people that weren't.
Yeah. And this helps give clarity on where that distinction was.
Yep. And then that point I brought up earlier, when you do remove bad apples, people will appreciate you for it.
Yeah.
Because people know. People know where the problems lie.
Yeah. But in this case, it sounds like those people left on their own for the most part.
Some of them, but not all of them.
Not all of them. Yeah.
Not all of them.
Did you have any resistance from individuals or groups of people, like kind of pushing back against your authority?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah. How'd you navigate that?
It just takes time. I understood why they were hesitant. I understood, like I said, I was the sixth guy in 6 years. Of course they were hesitant. Of course they're going to push back. But there was one, it was actually also really meaningful to me because it wasn't even the end. It was kind of halfway through at least, because he was a C-suite employee who really did not understand the value of UX, user experience. Mm-hmm. And he was on the technical side, and he was very, very hesitant to want to implement. He wasn't fighting me, but he was hesitant to implement the kinds of things that I wanted to do on the product side of the business, on the UX side, and on the front-end development side. And he came to me about halfway through my tenure there, and he said, look, it's like I really didn't understand what you were getting at. And, you know, the education you gave me in this really changed my mind. And I see the power of it now. And I just want you to know it was absolutely the right decision. And I appreciate you telling me, you know, teaching me all of this stuff. And I think, you know, once again, like it was all about education and helping people grow. And that's how I gained trust. And that's how the company was able to thrive.
So what? And for a lot of these people, they were their employees. They're getting their salary or whatever, right? But before you come in, they're getting paid. Then you come in, they're still getting paid, but there's a, like, from a self-interest standpoint, they're making their money, right? How would you distinguish yep. between the two of them? Like, what was it that the second that they had after you left versus what they had before you got there? If that makes sense.
Yeah, I think it's kind of a, I think it goes back to hope. It's not just hope. At the end, I mean, at the beginning, we clearly painted the picture of where the business was. We talked about the growth and decline of the business every single week. People saw, they no longer saw a rosy picture of where we were. They saw a realistic picture of where we were, painted against the background of hope. That even though the business was still doing this, especially in the beginning, that there was a brighter future for the business, and that we were going to have to go down through it to come back up and get to that brighter future. But they saw that path.
Yeah.
And once they saw it.
Yeah.
Yep.
Well, why did they care about that future?
Why did people in the business care about the future of the business?
Yeah.
Because
they could go work at some other company, right, and move on. But I'm just kind of trying to tease out what I
understand, because people want their organization to do a good job. This is a company that they have been with, in many cases, for 20 plus years. It was their home. It was all of their friends. It was their, you know, it was safety to them in a lot of cases. It's what they did every day for their lifetimes. And of course, like they bought in on it. They believed in the future of it, and they believed in the power of that team and the power of that product. And what the company did is something that I actually told them every week. We had a every week I would put on a presentation called This Week at Experience Care, where we would talk about the numbers and the growth and all these other things about the business. But at the end, I would note people's birthdays and people's work anniversaries. And if it was your birthday, I would get out my ukulele and I would sing you happy birthday. And the people, when it was people's work anniversaries, what I talked about was that this was a life well lived. This is something worth doing. That company is a company that provides software for the most fragile people in the entire country. It's software that supports them, provides for them, makes sure they get the right medicines, tries to cut down the amount of time it takes nurses to input documentation so that nurses can spend time with people in those facilities. That's something important. That's something worth doing with your life. It's something that impacts millions of people, and every single day makes a difference in somebody's life. It may not make a difference in a way that they can directly see, but every second a nurse gets to spend holding somebody's hand as they die, or being with their family, or taking care of somebody in pain, is a second that counts, is a second that makes a difference. And we give those seconds back to those nurses. And everybody knows that that's something worth doing.
Yeah. Well, I think that's a great place to wrap it up here.
Sounds good.
I appreciate it.
I have tons more in my lessons learned area, but I know we've been talking for a long time. So happy to talk more about it if you're interested.
Yeah, yeah. If people want to connect with you, if they want to learn more about this, if they want to keep going, like you could go for weeks or months on this topic, where do they go?
So right now you can go to ascendance.coach. However, I'm going to be digging into all of these lessons learned, putting together more and more PowerPoints, more and more presentations, more spreadsheets, more Word documents, more worksheets, all sorts of things in 2024, under the Ascendance brand, and I'm going to have a YouTube channel where we're going to go through all of that. I haven't launched it yet, but you can go to ascendance.coach and you can get on my newsletter, and I will let you know when it comes out. All this content is going to be free. It's important for me to be able to teach these things to business owners across the country and across the world, because I think it adds value to so many people in so many different ways for business owners to understand the best ways to run their businesses. And so that all of that information will be coming out on YouTube and on the website in 2024, and I'd love to have you on my list.
Sounds good. And then are you on social media anywhere that where you're most active?
You can get me on LinkedIn. Just, right. I think it's Jason M. Long 1.
All right. We'll put a link in the notes. And well, thank you so much, Jason, for sharing.
Yeah, absolutely. It's great to talk to you again. And thank you for this opportunity.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Share Life. For additional stories and systems to live better and work smarter, visit jasonscottmontoya.com. That's jasonscottmontoya.com. We look forward to having you listen in on the next episode of Share Life.
Are you a small business owner? Have you hit a glass ceiling where year over year, you cannot rise above a certain revenue level? Check out Jason Scott Montoya's book, The Jump, to discover how to level up your leadership and pivot your entrepreneurial passion to the highest level. The Jump, from Chaos to Clarity for Your Striving Small Business, is available on Amazon.